Coming up on Boston Public Radio, yet another app that allows posting of anonymous comments. And yes, it led to bomb threats, racial slurs, and more. So we'll ask you, is it time to end the era of anonymity? Then Globe editor Brian McGroyer on their story identifying the name and sketchy history of the FBI shooter of Ibrahim Todashev. He's the alleged partner with Tamerlan Tsarnaev of a triple murder in Waltham. Then medical ethicist Art Kaplan on Dr. Karl Rove and how the NFL locker room will treat openly gay Michael Sam.
We'll be joined by Don Berwick, Obama's Medicare and Medicaid czar, who is now seeking the Democratic nomination for Massachusetts governor, and WGBH arts editor Jared Bowen on new theater and movies around town, including Woody Allen's latest film, in which he plays, oh no, a pimp. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
I'd prefer in the future if you introduced me as wannabe meteorologist, Jim Browdy.
Okay.
And
you want to give us the update, Jim? It's warmer today.
No, I don't, because you have an attitude. In any case, maybe the closest thing all of us humans have to a superpower is anonymity. Can render us invisible and give us a sense of supremacy that we can't tap into when we're grounded in our known identity. It also gives us the power to hurt or help people without being found out. So the question for you is this a good thing? The latest frontier where anonymity rules and runs amok is in the app world. Front page of the Globe today, the app Yik Yak was designed with college students in mind. It's essentially a forum where people gossip anonymously, and the thrust of the rambling conversation often verges on bullying and shaming. So we want to know not just about Yik Yak, but in general about anonymity, whether it's comments on a news story or it's tweets. When is an anonymity a good thing? When should we own up to who and what we are saying at 877-301-8970? What kind of circumstances have you chosen to do something anonymously? And I guess the big question, Marjorie, is it time to end the era of anonymity? And obviously it reached a high point in the cyber era. We could still play some games prior to that, maybe in the 80s and before. But now it's very, very easy, with or without these apps, to maintain some level of anonymity. We're going to talk to Brian McGroyer a little bit about comments on stories like his old column, your column, stories in the Boston Globe, that sort of thing. I have to say, when you read these Yik Yak things and see there were bomb threats, there was bullying. At BC, Boston College has virtually the highest usage of Yik Yak in the country. 60% of the undergrads use it. I don't know if it's undergrad students. There was a letter published in the campus newspaper, The Heights, as reported by The Globe this morning. The letter cited Yik Yak posts such as, listen to this, quote, "Does hooking up with a Latina count as fulfilling cultural diversity?" And it's hilarious how you can tell which yaks are from black people because they text how they talk. I mean, so...
Yeah, and one of the women that is talking about this, she's an Asian woman. She's from the Philippines, and she said there's a lot of Asian slurs on there. And, you know, they did this this high school in Connecticut. By the way, we should point this out, that these have been banned, supposedly, by the people that created this app.
Thousands of high schools.
From middle schools and high schools. But it seems as though some of the kids are able to get access to it. Well, of course they are able to get access to it after school, so it's not that effective. But they do talk about, as you said, this. It was Marblehead High School where they had this bomb threat, which is kind of scary. And there was Staples High in Westport, Connecticut. I wonder if that was named after Staples. Do you think so?
I have no idea.
Anyway, a student there wrote an essay for New York Magazine just a couple of weeks ago about the havoc wreaked by the post there, and a few of the principal ones were, the cheer team couldn't get uglier, how long do we think before AB kills herself, and JT's going to get lynched at SMU. So they're kind of nasty. They're very nasty.
Kind of nasty. They're incredible. So, again, the big question, we've discussed this in other contexts with you, is it time to end anonymity? There are some people who think the answer is no, that there are some places where anonymity is a plus. For example, you are a particularly shy person. Some professors talk about this. You want to criticize people in power without fear of retribution. Those are pluses, but the question is, even if there are pluses that only come with anonymity, are they outweighed by the grotesque abuse of this? And I would say the answer is no, they are not. Our number is 877-301 8970. If you've used Yik Yak, let us know. If you have, I was going to say hidden behind anonymity. I don't know if that's fair, but I'll use it. Have you used anonymity to say something that you ordinarily would not otherwise say? And if you weren't anonymous, if you had to do your name, would you say the exact same thing? And by the way, for this segment only, everybody calling in has to give their first name, middle name, last name, home address, and cell phone number
and
on
social
the air.
Security number, Jim.
No,
why
I forgot
not?
That, too.
Yeah. You know what I thought was really fascinating, too? There's two young men. They're 23 years old who started this together. These Brooks Buffington.
I love
wow.
that name. That's pretty good.
And Tyler Drood, I guess that's how you pronounce it. Uh-huh. Anyway, the reason one of them gave for why they did this is, quote, "We saw on our college campus that only a few people really had a voice. They wanted to give kids a platform. Quote, the people with the voice are the big people with big Twitter accounts, maybe student athletes who had thousands of followers. My thought was, why can't everybody have this power?" So from his perspective, this is almost about, you know, becoming famous by your app handle or something on this.
By
on
his
this.
Alleged perspective. I mean, I would assume his perspective is making money. Where they did, the story goes on to say that despite some of the bad news, they've just gotten an additional $1.5 million of investment. You don't know if that's their real agenda.
Well, but I found that fascinating, that his thought was, why can't everybody have this power? Thinking that in the internet age, this is part of what it's about. That you know, if you're an anchor man, like some people we know are, mm-hmm. every night, then you have a platform. And if you're a newspaper reporter, you have a platform. If you're writing for the college paper, you have a platform. This gives everybody a platform.
No, it gives everybody an anonymous platform. Everybody has a platform. You can write a letter to the editor.
Yes.
You can tweet under your name. You can make a posting on a message board in your name.
But it gives them a place under their pseudonym or their app or whatever it is. It gives them a certain power.
I can't believe you, of all people, are making this case. The foulest comments I've ever seen on a columnist are often on your columns. Usually, you could be talking about the most tender story. They're often vicious condemnations of you as a person. And I'll tell you, 99% of those people would not have the courage to do that. And by the way, do you think those punks who were tweeting the N-word about Subban after he scored the winning goal in the first game against the Canadians with the Bruins, do you think that they would have tweeted those things had it been...
No, I don't. But I guess you're missing my point. My point
is why
people do this.
Oh, I understand why they do it.
It gives them a certain power in a certain environment, and the environment in this case is on this app.
I understand that. 877-301-8970. It also gives them the power to say things they wouldn't have the courage or I guess they would have the sense to do were it not for the protection of anonymity. And by the way, I see the arguments. I not only understand the reasoning, but I understand the arguments in favor of anonymity. But I think we've reached a point, as evidenced by how this Yik Yak is being used, where they are outweighed by the dangers of this kind. The bullying that goes on through this anonymity is intense and really a problem.
Yeah, and it's really, and we've seen this in these tragic cases in Massachusetts. This is not Yik Yak, obviously, but it was the Facebook postings and the internet postings that had to do with Phoebe Prince. It was
out in South Hadley.
That killed herself out in South Hadley. Anyway, our number is 877-301-8970. Have you ever used this Yik Yak? Do you think your kids at college, apparently it's huge at colleges, are using Yik Yak? Do you think that we would have a more civil discourse? We would, without question, if people had to attach their names to these things. Does it bother you so much that you're thinking about eradicating anonymity on the internet?
We would have a more inhibited discourse, though.
Yes.
It would be more civil, but it would be more inhibited.
That's right. 877-301-8970. So I guess the question is, do we want civility or do we want uninhibited kind of venting of all your deepest, darkest?
Well, some of us want uninhibited civility, which is, I know, an unlikely outcome, but that's our preference. Let's start in Peabody with Kathy. You're on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hi there, Kathy.
Hi. I absolutely agree with everything you've been saying. I had never heard, I have grandchildren who are of the age, the oldest is 15. And, of course, they're on their cell phones constantly, and they're texting and this and they're texting of that. And I just cannot believe the kinds of things that do go across, that the bullying and the this and the that and the other. And my youngest are like, the youngest grandchildren are four, twins. And they're already, you know, punching because they don't really know how to use anything but other than play games. But everything is so out of control, if you will, and it's terrifying to me.
Because essentially a huge percent of particularly the younger population figuratively and some literally live in their mother's basements. I mean, that is what we have in 2014. And if you strip that away, it is true there are going to be some people who will be inhibited from saying things that do matter. But I think that's possibly a price that we have to pay. Kathy, thank you for the call. You know, Dan Kennedy is the first example that comes to mind. The postings on his website, Media right. Nation, you must say who you are. You have to identify yourself. I don't know if I can't remember if you have to identify yourself publicly or you have to identify yourself with information to him, and then you can use some pseudonym. I'm not sure what it is, but the bottom line is he knows who you are.
Oh, we have a graduate of the Staples High School in Connecticut who wants us to know that Staples High School was not named after the store, but after the school's founder.
Oh. So I assume his name or her name was Staples.
Let's go to Worcester. Horace Staples, actually.
What's that?
Horace Staples.
I remember him well. Kim, and by the way, Horace Staples is the man after whom the stationery store Staples is named. Do you know that?
I did not know that,
exactly.
Jim.
Exactly. It's also not true. Kim is in Worcester. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Kim.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
So I had a couple of comments to make. One around anonymity. I think that there are times when that is crucial, like calling a crisis hotline, for example, not have to identify who you are.
That's a stop. That is a huge and very important point. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and the whole idea of the bullying is the culture and the society that we are all a part of and continue to perpetuate that it's okay to treat one another this way. And so the bigger question is really, what do we need to do to address that issue and a societal attitude that we have around how we treat one another? It's just getting so out of control. There's more access to being able to be anonymous and be actually abusive, you know, to individuals in these various format.
Well, by the way, that is exactly what the bigger picture is, but the bigger picture is going to need more time to find a solution. And I guess people like me are saying, and we should be more selective. You're right. I'm not suggesting, I shouldn't have been suggesting the end of anonymity in all circumstances because crisis hotlines, suicide hotlines, I mean, it's obviously critical to the success of these things, at least for some people, that there be anonymity. That was a great call, Kim. Thank you.
But, you know, I do think, at least in the schools, things are better, I mean, than they used to be. I think there's a lot more awareness in the schools and a lot more instruction from the teachers about respect and non-bullying. I mean, when you were a kid and got bullied in the schoolyard, the answer was the punch in the nose,
exactly.
Right? Wasn't that the answer?
So
we've made some progress.
But wait a second. Yes, we have made some progress. And clearly people in power are doing a far better job than the frighteningly inept responsibility-avoiding mm-hmm. head of the South Hadley Schools. You mentioned Phoebe Prince before, who knew much more than they were owning up to. But Boston College is one of the premier institutions in this country.
I know.
Does hooking up with Latina count as fulfilling cultural diversity? And Jack Dunn is the BC spokesperson. He's been busy the last couple of weeks. Says Yik Yak is the domain of the coward, which it is. And so while we're doing the long-term solutions that Kohler suggested, places like this are, I think, far more dangerous than they are helpful.
Stretch from Dorchester. What do you think, Stretch?
Hello, Stretch.
Before I get to my argument here, I want to just say that there's more Bruins fans in Dorchester than there is in Cambridge and Brookline combined.
Well, I would like to say that Steve Buckley from the Herald lives in Cambridge, so I will rest my case,
yeah,
Stretch.
I won't argue with you, though, Stretch.
And I'll rest my case, too.
Yeah, I won't argue with you on that one, Stretch. I think you're probably right. But what do you think about anonymity?
Hi, Stretch.
Unfortunately, it's a necessary evil when you have people who have the power and who get paid six-figure contracts to be on stations like this and bring in a governor who's the worst governor in the state, and they're begging him, kissing his rear end, asking him, please, run for president.
And hey, Stretch, can I tell you something? You know what, Stretch, if I may speak on my own biased show, I'm not sure if you're aware, there is a phone number, 877-301-8970, and when the governor of the Commonwealth comes in tomorrow, as he does every month, noon to one, you should have the courage to say the exact same thing to the governor himself. How about that, Stretch? And by the way, I would bet there are more people in Cambridge and Brookline than on your block in Dorchester who would have the courage to do it. But Stretch, thank you for your insulting call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. 89, 79.
I think he is the most popular governor we've had in recent history, although he's had his travails
in recent times. Bill Weld left office midterm, admittedly, wildly
popular. I think we'll see where he is when he leaves office, but he's been up in the 60s for most of his term.
I think a little lower now. 877-301-8970. And if you want to call to insult us, you call 555-555-5555. Let's go to Anthony. You are in Danvers. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call, Anthony.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie. I just wanted to add to the discussion. A lot of websites like USAtoday.com, a lot of them require that you use like a Facebook login comment on their stories. And a lot of the people say the same vicious things, even though they're not anonymous in that context. So I think that being anonymous doesn't always make you more likely to be like vile.
Well, I have to say I disagree with you. I don't think it eradicates it. If what you were taking away from my comment is what I think it would disappear, of course it wouldn't. Would it reduce it? I think the answer, I mean, I agree with Jack Dunn. Most of the people, most, not all of the people who make outrageous comments, who do bullying, cyberbullying and those sort of things, are cowards. There is a percentage of the population will say whatever they say regardless. But look at what's-his-face, Sterling, one of the most reviled people in America, thought the world would never know. Do you think he would have said those exact same things? Of course, he did say those things about Magic Johnson two nights ago. Forget that, Anthony. Anthony, that was a fine call. Obviously, it's not going to get rid of all of it. But think about it, by the way. When you read the comments on your own story, I read them all. I mean, on your stories. Often, I don't even read the column. I just read the comments.
You know how I love to hear that?
I'm sorry.
I didn't read the story, but I read the comments calling you a jerk.
But when you read the comments yourself, read them, you'll see, and you may be wrong on one or two cases, the vast majority of these people would never have the courage if they had to sign their name to it.
Well, what's one of the funniest thing about comments is that when the commenters get in fights with each other,
they
attack each other for the previous posting and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, there are stories in which the comments are fascinating. If it's one of those stories, we'll be discussing later with Brian McGrory about whether the Globe should have named these cops and this FBI agent. You know, where there's stories
in the Tardashev shooting.
Yes, yeah. in the Tardashev shooting, it's in the front page of the Boston Globe today. You can have an interesting debate in the comment section back and forth about an issue like that. I find those sorts of those instances interesting.
You know what's further proof? I want to respond more to Anthony's point, which had some merit a second ago, is, you know, a ton of those tweeters who use the N-word describing Subban, as soon as some research was done and they were identified, you know what they did? They shut down their Twitter accounts, which I would say is evidence, powerful evidence, that if their name had been known up front, they wouldn't have done it to begin with, because once people found out who they were, they immediately shut them down in the hopes that they would avoid some level of culpability. So it would clearly reduce the problem. But I do agree there's some circumstances that caller said a minute ago, like crisis hotlines, where anonymity is a huge, hugely important element.
And as you know, in the Subban case, there was debate about whether the media was making too big a deal about these tweets because there weren't that many of them. And was this really indicative of this widespread racism?
Well, you know why? Because it said the original report said it was trending in Boston, which was not true.
That's correct. But I think that, you know, did we make too much of it? Did we not make enough of it? What did it really mean? I don't know.
I agree. Let's go to Mike in the car. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for the call. Hi, Mike.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Hi.
Hey. Just a little bit of devil's advocate. I'm certainly not advocating bullying, but, you know, this is an app you actually have to go and download and search out. So you have to take an active role in getting involved in this.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, that's a great point.
It's not something like a schoolyard bully where you're at recess and you can't get away from somebody who wants to, you know, hit you with their book bag or something, which unfortunately did happen to me a few times. But, you know, and I'm certainly not pulling for the anonymous posters here. But, you know, there is a certain active role that goes into it. If you know it's a site that has all these vile comments on it, don't download the app. Don't get in there.
Well, and by the way, the woman that was Marjorie mentioned, is she a BC kid? I can't remember.
The senior at Boston College that was upset about all the Asian slurs?
Yeah, essentially she did it with the best of intentions. And what happened is exactly what you described, Mike. I mean, the figurative book bag in her case, words, and she ultimately got rid of the app. Mike, thanks for the call. Let's try to squeeze one more quick one in, Marjorie. John, you're in Providence. You're on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, John.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
So one of the things about anonymity when it comes down to posting and dispersing that I feel folks tend to forget is that anonymity can be used not as a tool for cowardice, but actually as a way to protect the conversation. Mm-hmm. It's a way of preventing us from trying to argue at a personal level, instead letting the information and letting the topic live on its own, arguing the point and not arguing the person. When anonymity is used properly, it does get abused, but I'd hope that our listeners get to remember that it can be used positively when it's done in that scope. Keep the person out if you're going to keep your identity out.
Yeah,
I hear that, but one would hope that in the vast majority of cases that your belief in that which you're arguing is strong enough that you're willing to attach your name to it. The exception, I would argue, is if you were having that debate with someone who has far more power than you do. And as I said at the beginning, if you're worried about some sort of retaliation, then I think you are totally right. John, thank you for the call.
Up next, we're going to talk to the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGroy, and we'll ask him about this whole anonymity thing, too, because he obviously runs a newspaper, thinks about it all the time, as well as the latest developments in the Ibrahim Tornishev case. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Today at WGBHnews.org, the NSA botched the clues to 9/11. But does domestic spying make up for the loss? If you missed the discussion on Boston Public Radio, catch it online at WGBHnews.org right now.
Here in New England, many employers offer matching gift programs. So your gift to WGBH could be doubled or even tripled without your spending another dime. Learn more at wgbh.org/matching gifts.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Lowell Institute, sponsoring free public lectures since 1839, including Key Issues, Election 2014, May 14th, presented by Cambridge Forum at the First Parish Church, Cambridge. More at lowellinstitute.org. And the Boston Pops, Tony Award-winning actor and Kinky Boots Broadway star Billy Porter joins Keith Lockhart and the Pops at Symphony Hall for a night of musical hits, May 20th and 21st. bostonpops.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Joining us on the phone is the editor of the Boston Globe. He does that every Wednesday, not editor, but joins us. Hello there, Brian McGroy.
Hello there, Jim Browdy. Hello, Marjorie. How are you?
Good afternoon, Brian. I'm terrific. You know, I'm so glad we're talking to you today because we have been talking for months, obsessing in our case anyway, over this lack of transparency about the killing almost a year ago in Florida of Ibrahim Tornishev. And if people don't remember, he's the guy that was a friend of marathon bomber Tamerlan Tsarnaev and was signing a confession involving a triple murder in Waltham, reportedly the night he died. Anyway, you guys have a front-page story, Maria Sacchetti, that names the two Massachusetts state troopers that were there that night and the FBI agent who shot Tornishev and apparently, according to your story, had an extremely troubled past. Tell us about it, Brian.
Well, we did make the decision in today's story to name the FBI shooter in that apartment in Orlando when Tornishev was shot last year, along with the two Massachusetts troopers. This occurred after Ibrahim Tornishev gave what law enforcement officers and agents there was a confession to the triple murder in Waltham in 2011. And you know, it was a bit of a it was an interesting decision to make. And ultimately, what guided us to this place was the fact that that FBI agent, Aaron McFarlane, had a bit of a troubled past and when he served as a police officer in Oakland back in the early 2000s.
And specifically, Maria Sacchetti writes, in 4 years, Officer McFarlane took the fifth at a police corruption trial, was the subject of two police brutality lawsuits and four internal affairs investigations. The head of the police union out there, the police chief, says he was a great cop, but a lot of the people involved in litigation suggest otherwise. When you said you made the decision, Brian, to do this, I assume it's in response to what Sacchetti writes later in an article. The FBI refused to discuss McFarlane's work history, saying he could threaten his safety. Quote, publishing the alleged name of the agent involved in the shooting incident serves no public interest or service except to foster continued media scrutiny. The personal safety of the agent continues to be of concern to the Boston Division, and publishing the agent's name potentially places the agent and family at risk for reprisal. Tell us the thought process that you and others went through when you heard that from the FBI, please.
Well, our thought process was fairly extensive. We've been thinking about this for a while. Maria Cecchetti, who is a terrific reporter, has been reporting this out for quite some time now. And the bottom line is we disagree with the FBI. I disagree with the FBI. I do think there's a public interest in letting people know who it was that fired the gun in that apartment that caused what is in all likelihood, a significant witness in the Marathon bombing case and possibly a participant in the triple murder in Waltham to die. And, I mean, in terms of the agent being in any sort of mortal danger because of our reporting, I mean, the reality is that we simply found his name by using basic technology to unredact a document that was issued by authorities. So if we could do that, certainly anyone who wanted to see this guy dead could also do that as well. So his name has also been reported out on a blog. And, we just believe in erring on the side of more information so the public can make their own decisions about, you know, what did or did not happen in Orlando.
Well, Brian McGrory, editor of the Boston Globe, no one wants to make light of anybody's public safety, certainly not police officers. But
nor do we at the Globe.
Well, no one does. But the fact of the matter is, if identifying people involved in criminal cases was putting everybody in danger, you wouldn't have judges would be deciding cases with bags over their heads and no names involved because they're sending dangerous people off to jail all the time. Reporters wouldn't be writing about dangerous criminal cases. So and police officers go into their profession knowing there was a certain element of danger. I don't mean to be hyperbolic here, but I find this statement by the FBI kind of ridiculous.
Well, I'm not there that it's ridiculous. I respect an agency that wants to do anything they can or anything they deem appropriate to protect their own agents and officers. So I don't. I'm not there. We took their request very seriously, but ultimately, when a law enforcement agent pulls the trigger of their gun and somebody ends up dead, and that person who pulled the trigger does have a background that it would probably behoove the public to know about, then we're going to print the name. It's just where we ended up in this case.
Also, I think there's a bit of background. Obviously, you speak for the Globe, and I speak for me. There's a history here where the FBI agent in this case was not even allowed by his bosses to speak in confidence anonymously to the Florida state attorney who put the report out on this. All there was a statement that he was able to see. I also think that most of us who read the piece in the Globe today would say, consider this, let's be kind, checkered work history at the Oakland Police Department, which allowed him to retire at 31, by the way, for another day, at a $52,000 a year for life
That's
pension.
31.
But retiring at 31 after this checkered history in all these cases, why did the FBI hire him? And I know that question is not addressed today. I assume at some point it will be, but that's a pretty critical...
Jim, the question is raised.
How so?
In the story. There are lawyers in California who dealt with cases involving Aaron McFarland who asked us, and we quoted them saying, we don't know how the FBI, who has their pick of the cream of the law enforcement crop, ended up hiring him. It's a legitimate question to ask.
No. I read that. I meant I would like to hear what the FBI's answer to that question is why is this man who left the Oakland police force under those circumstances, why was he deemed appropriate to be an FBI hire? So I have to say I'm totally with Marjorie. And the one line that matters most to me is this guy, Jeffrey Albert, is quoted in the Globe story this morning. He's a professor of criminology at the University of South Carolina. This is how I feel about all these things, unless there is some great, exceptional, extraordinary security issue. The public has the right to know if an officer shoots his weapon. They work for us, which is the argument, by the way, the Civil Liberties Union made to Martha Coakley about investigating the two state troopers, who you also name, who apparently have a fine work history in terms of her questioning the two officers who, quote, work for us.
Yeah, the other thing we should point out is that the two Massachusetts state troopers that are identified in Marie Cicchetti's story, Curtis Sinelli and Joel Gagne, one is a veteran trooper with several commendations, as you guys report today. Brian specializes in hunting fugitives, and Gagne is the lead investigator of the killing of the three young men at Waltham. And by the way, Brian, when I said I thought the FBI's statement was ridiculous, I guess what I'm saying is police officers face danger every single day. day they leave home, as we know, because they're in a violent business, you know, with their guns, with their weapons, going out to fight crime. So that the idea that this would put them in any particular danger above and beyond that, I wasn't really sure what they meant, that there was going to be some people from Chechnya that were going to come over and retaliate. You know what I'm saying?
No, I know exactly what you're saying, Marjorie, and you know, I do just want to stress we did take their request seriously, and ultimately, you know, we just decided that it was in the public interest to name, especially the FBI agent who fired the weapon, but also, you know, the two Massachusetts troopers, as you both point out, perfectly good work
yep.
histories, won many commendations, so. I mean, look, we're in the business of providing information, not withholding information, and that's what we did here.
Well, so I will be less responsible than Brian to end this part of our discussion this afternoon. One of the reasons, Marjorie, in my estimation, they didn't want this out is not for his safety, but because if it's out, then a reporter like Maria Sacchetti can do some work and find out that the guy, before he was hired by the FBI and years before he fired these six or seven shots, had a very troubling history as a police officer.
Well,
in Oakland. And if you don't identify him, then you don't have that information.
I mean, you said that. And look, I appreciate that point very much. And I'd only add that Maria Sacchetti did some really terrific work tracking down the information. It's exactly why we, I mean, look, I don't mean to ride a high horse here, but it's exactly why we have a free press. And we're not in, we don't work in conjunction with law enforcement agencies. And somehow, various times we have diverging interests.
I just want to point out one more thing that you guys said, and we've talked about this before as well, Brian McGroy from The Globe, that the prosecutor who investigated this shooting said in March that he declined to interview this FBI agent McFarland directly because the FBI would not let him record the interview. So the FBI provided Ashton with the agent's statements. And to me, this just underscores again the fact that the FBI seems to be able to not adhere to the normal rules of procedure here in not just this case, but other cases, and they're not ever called to task.
Well, they were this morning.
There are reasonable people can come to the determination that there are profound and fundamental flaws in the way this event at the apartment was investigated. But I'd also like to add that there are aspects of this, which, despite Maria Sacchetti's great digging, still remain secret. And we now know, we did know, that there is a recording out there of Todashev's confession that was done by the two state troopers.
Yeah, great
now,
point.
If you assume that there are no remaining suspects in the Waltham case, in the Marathon bombing case, why is it that that recording has not been made public so that we can get a sense of what did happen in that apartment? There's, from what I can see and from what I've, you know, the little that we've been able to glean from anyone in law enforcement, there's no good reason to not let the public inside that apartment to see what it is that happened that night and to, you know, hear in Todashev's own voice what did happen in Waltham in 2011.
You know, I should know this answer. I'm sure you and Marjorie do. Is that FOIA-able, Freedom of Information request, susceptible? Can an FOIA request be made for something like that that's a police record?
I don't think so, but we are exploring that.
Okay.
But I don't think so.
Brian, let's move on if we can. Last week when we spoke to you about your series on the college rental ghetto in Boston, your final words were something like, we're not done. There's more to come. When you read the story in your own paper yesterday where Marty Walsh has replaced the head of inspectional services in Boston, which I think was one of the many culprits. Marjorie thinks the number one culprit is the colleges themselves, and I tend to agree with her. And Marty Walsh, the mayor, said this had nothing to do with the series in the Globe because I'm moving him over to BRA. I would have fired him, Hadid, et cetera. What, did you think that passed the laugh test?
Look, you guys are in rare form.
Did it?
Am I laughing now?
So the answer is it didn't pass the last.
Everyone was laughing when they saw that statement.
By the way, if you think Brian McGroy is calling from the bunker in Framingham, he's on a cell phone, which he never is today. That was the only alternative, so that's why the sound is somewhat compromised. Go ahead, Brian.
Look, the mayor is Mayor Walsh has said that our three-part series on off-campus housing in Boston didn't have anything to do with moving Brian Glasscock. And look, I'm not going to dispute that in any way. I mean, he has changed department heads around. This may have been occurring anyways. I don't know. He says he didn't demote Glasscock, and that may well be true. I mean, I can only tell you that what I told you last week, and that is that the three-part series concluded, but we're going to continue with some really good stories coming up. We're going to continue to look at the situation in Boston with off-campus housing, and there are multiple parties, as we've already pointed out, that have a major role here, and it goes far beyond ISD.
By the way, just so you don't, you said a minute ago you guys are in rare form, meaning asking questions that are inappropriate for the editor
here.
Of the Globe.
We're worked up.
Let me say, we could have asked you to explain to us in detail the unredaction process of the names of the officers. And, I mean, but we chose not to, Brian. So.
God, it sounds much easier than I thought it was. I thought it was impossible. I guess it isn't. That's good to know.
You know, Brian, we started but
Jim, actually, that gets to a somewhat serious point.
Yeah.
And that is, if the FBI, if the U.S. government thought that their agent would be in danger if his name was put into the public realm, why didn't they properly redact the name of public documents? I mean, please.
That's an excellent point.
You know, Brian, we started today's show talking about another piece in your paper today about this Yik Yak, this smartphone app that allows people to comment anonymously. And obviously, there have been a lot of issues attended to it. And we talked to people about whether or not, it's time to end the era of anonymity, which leads me to something I meant to ask you a few weeks ago, but forgot. And an emailer suggested this. Two things. One, have you ever considered not allowing anonymous comments to Globe stories, meaning you have to state your name? And two, as a corollary to that, how do you decide which stories, and there are few of them, don't have a comment section when they run online in the Boston Globe?
It's a really good question. It's a really good question. It's something we wrestle with all the time. I mean, as it is now, you have to be a Globe subscriber to post a comment on bostonglobe.com. So we assume, as we've all come to understand, that every Globe subscriber is an upstanding human being with wonderful values. So we think that helps the cause. That said, there are still comments that slip through that we find very regrettable. I mean, you've seen these rat holes that too often result from commenters going at each other, going at reporters, going at subjects or stories. I mean, Marjorie, you and I have talked about whether you ever read the comments on your columns. I rarely looked at the comments on my columns.
Too depressing.
It is. I mean, I do believe that comments on Globe stories tend to be a little more straightforward, a little more forthcoming, a little more civil. That said, there are still times when it kind of flames out, and I often wonder: do we kill it altogether? Do we charge people a dime to comment? Do we, is there another solution here? So, Jim, you raised the point: there are stories we don't allow comments, and our digital producers and editors, as well as our regular editors, tend to have a good sense of what kinds of stories might just inspire comments that we are immediately going to find regrettable, and we tend to turn the comment switch off on those.
Like what kind of stories? Is there any particular sort of story that invites those kind of comments?
I mean, generally, we don't want people, stories that involve somebody who was killed, or
yeah.
We don't want comments on that kind of thing. There are some political stories where we tend to turn the comments off. There are stories where, you know, we think that the subject of the story is in a particularly vulnerable position, and the last thing we want them to do is go down to the end of the story and say, oh, I wonder what people are saying about me, and find out that they're not saying great things. So if we think that a subject can be adversely affected at a time when they shouldn't be, we'll turn the comments off on that. I mean, there's a wide variety of reasons to do it. The reason not to do it is that ideally these comments bring about a sense of community and give an opportunity for people to talk to each other and to talk about the issues of the day and what they're reading in the paper. That's how it plays out in perfection, but it doesn't always happen that way, as we well know.
You know, I there are so many instances where you've done stories, and I've done stories, and a lot of us have done stories about somebody who was killed. And lately, when you do those kinds of stories, and it's particularly if there's a lot of racist comments on stories that don't get taken down as quickly as everybody wants them to, and you almost feel like you have to warn the family members that you're interviewing not to look at the comments because some of them are going to be nasty, and I think the people and the families are always stunned that anybody would pick at them. At them or they're the person that died, you know what I mean? And they're our tragedy, and they do.
It is depressing, and we're constantly monitoring these comments, but as you say, a lot of them don't come down quick enough, but we're also constantly thinking, is there a better way? Is there something else we can do here so that we don't invite this kind of pain on people who simply don't deserve it.
Well, one last very quick thing here, the thing I wasn't clear about. Have you considered on stories where you do allow comments, which is the vast majority of them, having people have to say who they are?
Yeah, but how do you, I mean, is there a way to do that? I mean,
actually verify their identity?
Yeah,
I don't know what the answer to that is.
I mean, I think we do take steps in that direction, but, I think it's a little harder than you might think to accomplish.
Okay. Now, Brian,
let's
Marjorie
move on.
And I...
Yeah, we want to move on to a more cheerful subject here,
we had a big debate this morning.
We did have a big debate this
morning.
Go ahead,
explain to
Brian.
We
were thinking about the days when Brian McRoy was a Metro columnist of the Boston Globe, and many's the time I'd pick up the paper, and he was getting a scoop. And he'd be getting the scoop in a certain atmosphere over a nice, fine filet drizzled with hazelnut sauce at the Capitol Grill or
Grill 23,
one of those places. Yeah. And I'm not sure. Maybe we missed it. Did you do many columns starting out at Charlie's Sandwich Shop, Brian McRoy?
Well, first of all, Marjorie, you're stretching the truth in a way that I find very uncomfortable. There is nobody that would ever put a hazelnut sauce on a steak.
I'm sorry.
So,
okay.
Let's be very clear about that.
Okay. I don't even know what hazelnut sauce is.
But the concept works. Yeah, go ahead.
I will have you know that Charlie's won the James Beard Award back in the, I don't remember the exact year, but it was a few years ago.
Wow.
The James Beard is an American classic. And the James Beard Award is, Jim, is like the Nobel Prize for the foodie set.
We actually discussed them. Jamie Bissonette and Barbara Lynch won the other day.
Barbara Lynch won Restaurateur of the Year this year nationally.
Yeah.
Jamie Bissonette won a regional award, which is also a big deal. But Charlie's won a national award as an American classic restaurant. And I went over there. I have eaten there. I went over there. I met the siblings who run it. They could not be a nicer family. And we had a great time that day. They told some great stories, and I wrote a column about this wonderful group of four siblings raking in the most prestigious award in food you can get for their diner in the South End. It was a whole lot of fun. They're just a really nice group.
So maintaining anonymity, I will just tell you, one of us was wrong. Let's just leave it at that. Brian McGrory, by the way, please pass our congratulations to Maria Sacchetti. We both think it was a really, really important story, and it's great to talk to you.
Thank you.
I will absolutely do that. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Brian McGrory is editor of the Boston Globe. We talk to him every Wednesday. And up next, medical ethicist Art Kaplan joins us to go over the latest medical headlines. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Take American technology and Chinese money, and you might be able to get some surprising results.
I think very few realize that the Chinese government is putting anywhere from $60 to $80 billion a year, every year for the next 10 years, into clean tech-related investments.
I'm Kai Rizdal. That story and the rest of the day's business news next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6, here on WGBH Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you and the Museum of Science, where you can step inside the Hall of Human Life and exhibit you and discover how everyday human behavior affects our brains, our bodies, and the world around us. Details at mos.org/exhibit you. And Safety Insurance partnered with Safe Roads Alliance and In Control Crash Prevention Training to help educate teens and drivers of all ages about safe driving practices. You can learn more at safetyinsurance.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. There's no denying that GOP operative Karl Rove is a brilliant spin doctor, but medical doctor? Does he really have the right to diagnose Hillary Clinton with brain damage? And while we're talking about damaged brains, should Donald Sterling be exempted from his racist remarks if it turns out he really has dementia? Joining us on the line to talk about these and other medical ethical issues is Art Kaplan. Art, as you know, is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. Also co-edited the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Hello again, Art.
Hello, hello.
Good morning.
Hey, how are you?
Or good afternoon, I should say. Whoops. Anyway, glad you're here, Art Kaplan. So, Art, as soon as we heard this story about Karl Rove going to this conference and saying that Hillary Clinton, who had that blood clot after she fell down December 2012, that when she wore glasses that are only for people who have traumatic brain injury, and that's his quote, this he implied that she had brain damage. Jim and I said to ourselves, we need Art Kaplan to get to the bottom of this. And here you are. So what's the deal?
Well, the last time I saw those kind of glasses was on Harry Potter, as a matter of fact,
Exactly.
Magical glasses. I don't think there are any such glasses. I don't know why Dr. Rove is making these diagnoses from his distant perch, far away from where Ms. Clinton is, but it looks to me all politics, no medicine. And I don't think we should put up with it, actually. He should really be forced to walk all that back. It's just nonsense. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's just playing a political game. In fact, I was thinking to myself, where was he when they were wheeling old Strom Thurmond in at 152 into the Senate to vote on things, who clearly was not with it?
Well, actually, where he was Strom's best man when he married a 23-year-old when he was 115. You know, but one thing that, and incidentally, in all fairness to Karl Rove, the next day he said, quote, of course she doesn't have brain damage. Now, he doesn't know that anymore than he knew whether she did. But the underlying issue, which is a serious issue, which I assume you've thought about from time to time, Art Kaplan, is how full and thorough should the disclosure of people, assuming she runs for president, be if someone wants to be leader of the free world, whether they're going to be 69 when she takes office, which she would be, or 49. Is that a debate anymore, or do most politicians acknowledge we've got to tell you virtually everything?
Well, they do acknowledge it, at least the ones running for the top office, president. We don't get it quite at the level of your congressman and so on. I do think it's still an issue, and I think the problem is twofold. One, you know, sort of what's the cutoff? I'd be willing to say, president, you're running for president, you're running for vice president, you probably ought to disclose all medical records. But what I'd really like to see is an independent evaluation by some appointed body of doctors so that it's not just your doctors saying this is what's wrong with you, because there's clearly a conflict of interest there. And in fact, it's hard to be your doctor if you're going to be telling the world what's wrong with you. So I would like to see, although it seems to come up every presidential election about the health of candidates, and we don't do it, but an independent board examining people for issues that might be relevant, let's say, to their ability to do the office.
We're talking with Art Kaplan, our favorite medical ethicist, our only medical ethicist.
I was just going to say, how many medical ethicists do you know, Marjorie?
It's the only one I know. Anyway.
I'll still take the favorite thing. That's good.
Well, you wrote a terrific piece about Michael Sam. He's, of course, the guy that was just drafted by the St. Louis Rams into the NFL, the only guy that announced publicly that he was gay before the draft. Your piece was about how Michael Sam would be treated in the NFL locker room. What'd you write?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of attention to how the NFL and its fans are going to receive this now publicly announced gay athlete. And there was a ton of attention to the fact that when he was drafted, they had cameras in there watching his reaction, and he kissed his boyfriend. So Michael Sam's kiss has became a huge issue. Some people saying they turned him off, I didn't like it. Others saying, you know, who cares? I was more in the who cares side of things. I'm not sure I need to see draftees smooching anybody, but all right.
But we have, I mean, in all fairness, and you know this, we've seen virtually every draftee crying and then smooching someone.
That's what I meant.
And heterosexually.
I'm not sure I care. I'm not too worried about who they're smooching. I'm not sure I need to see their little family response. But if people like that, and, you know, we're getting more mature about homosexuality, then yeah, he's going to kiss his partner, and that's sort of how it is. But more to the point of Marjorie's question, to me, what I know about bullying and harassment in sports is it really matters as to what the leadership in the locker room does. It doesn't matter what the fans say. It doesn't matter what the media say. It doesn't matter what blogs say. It doesn't matter if people say, I'm uncomfortable about him kissing his partner. What's going to be important for him, and I think we'll set the tone then for the rest of professional football and ultimately all sports, will the leaders in the locker room, coaches, alumni who visit there, say in Boston, if some famous Patriots from the past drop by, what's Tom Brady going to do? Those are the guys who set the tone. And if they accept him and really say he's a brother, he's part of a team, we have each other's back, I think things will go just dandy for Michael Sam. That is, if he makes the team.
Right, of course. You quote in your piece Harry Carson, for those who don't remember, former linebacker for the Giants, Hall of Famer, former captain. He's speaking at your place at NYU, mm-hmm. New York University. Mm-hmm. What was the thrust of what Carson had to say, Art Kaplan?
Yeah, so we had Carson come in to talk a little bit about issues in professional football, and I got a chance to ask him about this, and he said, look, we had a guy in our locker room who everybody knew was gay, and this was, you know, 35 years ago. We didn't care. We just wanted to know if he could play the position. We had his back. We didn't say anything. We treated him as just as they would anybody else. And that's what a good leader does. So he basically said, we've already dealt with this. We didn't make a big deal about it. The person in question didn't come out at the time, but they knew. And so he basically said, what a leader does is make sure that everybody treats each other with respect. And I think that's the lesson, by the way, that even at the high school level, junior high school level, that's what we want to get into when we think about things like bullying. The leaders, coaches, captains, that group of people, they set the ethical tone. That's where we have to really expect them to say, look, it's a team. It's diverse. We've got a lot of different backgrounds, a lot of personalities. We're going to pull for one another, but we're not going to exclude or isolate anybody.
But is there a lesson that goes beyond the locker room, whether it's the New York Giants locker room or the St. Louis Rams with Michael Sam or that high school locker room you're talking about? Is there a transferable moral to this story that could be used in the non-locker room world?
I think it could be used in the workplace. I think it can be used at the country club. I think it could be used anywhere. And the lesson's pretty simple. It is, we treat each other with respect to get the job done that we need to get done. When you're a leader, you set the moral tone. People look to you. If you make fun of or bully or harass somebody, it's infectious. Other people are going to do it. When you say, not on my watch, we don't do that here. In pro sports, they say we check that right away, meaning they block it or stop it. Part of being a good leader, whether you're a CEO or somebody who's a leader in a hospital or a hospital administrator or an executive at a public radio station, is you set the tone. And that, I think, is the big – that's the lesson there. That's really how ethics works.
Let's say on sports-related things, we're going to play some sound from a couple of nights ago from Anderson Cooper's interview with the most hated man in America, I guess, Donald Sterling, soon to be, at least if the NBA has its way, the former owner – of the Los Angeles Clippers. Here are two sound bites of Sterling with Anderson Cooper glom together. Please listen.
I'm a good member who made a mistake, and I'm apologizing, and I'm asking for forgiveness. Am I entitled to one mistake? Am I, after 35 years, everybody wants to be cared for. I made such a mistake. I thought that woman really cared for me.
You know, when you watch both pieces there, you first see a guy trying to apologize. You then, of course, we didn't play what everybody's been talking about, his disparagement of Magic Johnson. It's sort of like, by the way, I'm not a racist, but let me talk about a black guy who really is contemptuous, who's done great things, even though I'm denying them, for other African-Americans. And then he does this, I thought, quite sad thing about an old guy wanting to be loved, wanting to be cared for. So when you watch this, do you see a racist or do you see a guy with dementia or both? How do you view Donald Sterling, Art Kaplan?
By the way, that's what his wife says.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
She thinks he does have dementia.
I don't know. I'm not going to do that Karl Rove thing and say from where I sit he's not.
Yeah.
But I do say this, until proven that he's not competent, and by the way, I feel this way about Oscar Pistorius, who these days is showing up in court saying, maybe I'm crazy,
yeah.
Just got introduced into his trial after the killing of his girlfriend. Until proven otherwise, you presume competent. And so I'm going to take him at face value, and I think he is a racist. By the way, I think he's a racist for some other remarks he said. You remember his comments about what Jews do and how they rally around one another and take care of one another? You know, that was positive, but it's still stereotyping a group. I think this guy's, at his core, a racist. And until somebody shows me, you know, he's got degenerative brain disease or something's wrong in terms of Alzheimer's or something like that, I take him at his word. The NBA took him at his word. They didn't throw him out for being incompetent, you know, prior to all this.
Yeah.
So sadly, I think we got just a evil guy.
Well, let's fast forward for a second and do a generic Donald Sterling. And in a month, there is a diagnosis from a credible source that the guy does have early onset dementia or some such thing. My sense is that we are still in a state in this country where we are totally intolerant of and not understanding of people who have mental illness or those sort of things, meaning even if it could be attributed, and I have no idea either, obviously, if you don't, I particularly don't, if that's where all this came from, we don't forgive behavior, whether it's a crime or a racist remark or anything in this country, even if it's demonstrated conclusively that it's born of mental illness, not born of hate or criminality. That's a fair statement, isn't it?
I think that's true, although there's something else, Jim. This guy's got a history.
Oh, I know.
He's got
that,
a public record, and he didn't sort of turn into a racist, you know, last month.
Right. That's why I tried to take it away, Art, from Sterling, because we all know about the housing discrimination lawsuits.
Right,
but I mean,
exactly.
In general, as I say, the generic lowercase Donald Sterling, we're never forgiving of anybody. We are, of course, not. If someone commits
with mental illness,
if someone commits a crime, how about the kid who was the killer? I'm not saying you should forgive the killer who had Asperger's, and he's probably
made in Newtown.
No.
Well,
there's a guy also in Massachusetts who killed his girlfriend.
Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
Who killed another child in the bathroom at a school? That's what happened.
But there seems to me to be a complete lack of acceptance, even if a panel of doctors and ethicists said this guy knew not what he did, whoever he or she
is.
Yeah,
I agree.
No?
Yeah, I do. And I think you're right. I think popular opinion still says you do evil acts or you make evil remarks. These are still going to be evil inherently, and we're sorry if they issued from impaired or damaged mental state. I think that's true. The law doesn't do it. The law can be more forgiving, and in that way we've gotten a little bit more humane about things when you do something because you simply are not able to be competent in any way. But morally, I think you're right. I think you still tend to condemn the content or condemn the behavior, and we're less interested in where it came from. Now, maybe that's poor and intolerant on our part in terms of the response to mental illness, but I think what we're trying to say is we have nothing to do with the merit of the message and probably just mix the two up. So hard to distinguish them, no doubt about it.
Yeah,
source and the content.
To both of you, I've often thought if more juries were allowed to find someone guilty but insane,
some states have, by the way.
Exactly. You'd solve a big problem because I think people don't want to find you not guilty by reason of insanity because they're afraid you'll be out of jail in a year or 2 years.
So Marjorie, this ties up to a little futuristic thing, but you know, we're doing more brain scans and we're learning more about the brain and what's abnormal and what's going on in there and so forth. I think we are going to move in your direction. That is to say, I think we're going to see more bad behavior coming from damaged brains, coming from, you know, you can demonstrate in a courtroom through pictures and images and scans that this person's got something wrong with them. And I think that'll shift us away from the punishment and more toward the therapy. Not tomorrow morning, but it's coming.
Yeah. Well, I think that would be a good thing because I think people do have empathy for mental illness. But anyway, not enough. But in any case, let's move on to Ritalin. Maybe this is why people have problems later in life, because when they were in college, they were not just doing the no-dos of that many of us did decades ago or drinking espresso. But now, apparently, lots of kids, according to this Washington Post piece, are using, misusing, I should say, Ritalin. They're using Ritalin to keep them awake during exam times. Exam times are just over the last few days, and apparently thousands of kids all across America were misusing this drug. But the premise of this piece is that it's okay to keep yourself up all night with Red Bull or No-Dos or cafe lattes, but it's wrong to use Ritalin because that's a crime.
No, wrong's not strong enough. Cheating. You are cheating if you do Ritalin because it's illegal. You obtained it illegally, but you're not cheating if you did No-Dos.
Yeah.
And that's out of the Children's Medical Center in your town of New York.
So what do you think about that?
So I'm tough on this one, and I'm really mad at our colleges and universities, and by the way, high schools. This isn't just a college problem. They got codes of conduct. They have honor codes. They lay out what cheating is. They say if you plagiarize, you know, copy from somebody else or copy from stuff on the internet and so forth or out of the library, that's cheating. They haven't set any standards out. What's the biggest drug problem in the United States today? Either of you know?
Nope. I don't.
Prescription drug abuse.
Yeah.
When you start in high school and you think, oh, you know, I could do this. I'll borrow mom's Ritalin or steal it out of the medicine cabinet or swap it off with somebody who's got it as a prescription. That's where a lot of that behavior starts. It leads to all kinds of trouble later in terms of nasty side effects and drug abuse and so forth. So I do think it ought to be seen as a form of cheating. I do think we ought to discourage it. Now, all you college and high school kids are now doubled over in laughter. I didn't say you could always enforce it, but you at least could take a stand and say, don't use illegal drugs. When you stay up all night swallowing Red Bull, that's not good for you. We as a college or a high school don't want you to do that. And I'm not even sure that really leads to the best test performance, but let's put that on the side. But my point is this. Set out your standards, try to promote health, try to get kids not to go, you know, lose it when they're facing exams, doing anything and everything they can to succeed. I don't think that's the right position. But as far as I can tell, no college, university, or high school that I've seen has any comment about this rampant drug abuse. I mean, they don't have it in their honor code. They don't have any statements about it.
You know what I thought was one of the interesting things in this story, too, is that they said that there's a certain kind of kid that winds up using or misusing, I should say, prescription drugs. It's the kids that play varsity sports and belong to fraternities or sororities. Mm. So I don't know what to make of that.
Hey,
well,
Art,
you know,
did you take...
There's drug culture there, too. There's drug culture there, too, in terms of, you know, steroids and other things. So maybe sliding off of that way. We have alcohol abuse there. I think I'm getting into an episode of Reefer Madness here, but I don't know what's a gateway to what, but at least the culturally, you don't want to support doing what it takes, so to speak, to do well, because I don't think you do well by taking anything, and I don't think that's the right position to have in your educational environment.
Well, I tend to agree with that, but that really, it seems to me that really isn't the question. The question is, while it is illegal to use a prescription drug that was not prescribed for you, and maybe there should be some sanction there, it seems to me to be beyond arbitrary that a school would determine that if you use No-Dos, like Marjorie and I did, or Red Bull didn't exist when we were in college, that's okay.
I knew you guys were cheaters.
But a prescription drug from your roommate
because it's not
is
illegal.
Not okay.
That's what they're saying. In this story, they're saying
but
the
why is that cheating?
Is,
what's the relevance to the cheating issue?
Because you can go to CVS and buy a legal No-Dos,
yeah.
And this is an illegal drug.
I understand the concept.
A use of
I just
drug,
don't buy.
I
just don't buy it. I mean,
yeah.
I buy the notion that prescription drug abuse is a real serious problem. I just don't see the way to enforce that or deal with that problem is through cheating allegations against somebody who takes it. So I guess.
Well, I'm not sure I care whether it's cheating or whether it's health. My point is, say something about it. Let's get a little more sane about how we treat the whole environment. I'm not, you know, if we could get people to not take somebody else's Ritalin by saying, that's not the right thing to do. It's not the healthy thing to do. We don't want you to do
I
that.
I agree
at
with
least
that.
Say that.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree with that. Okay.
Of course, they never listen, do they?
What's that?
They
no,
never
that's
listen,
why I
they?
Said they were laughing while I was talking. I heard it. I heard
exactly.
The laugh.
They're actually calling in as we speak. Last thing here. We've discussed Fed Up with virtually every guest we've had this week. And Fed Up, obviously, is the new movie, the Laurie David, Katie Couric, and I can't think of the woman who's the third woman involved in this. It's essentially the title we've given is Sugar Kills. It's about obesity in America, particularly childhood obesity. And all of us grew up, for those of us who have been dieting off and on our whole lives, this is me, not Marjorie, it's always been all calories are created equal. Is the message of Fed Up that all calories are not created equal, and should that be one that we take seriously in terms of our health and our fitness and that sort of thing?
Well, I don't think all calories are different. I think calorie is a calorie, so whether it comes from sugar or carbohydrates or chewing on cardboard, whatever the caloric value is of the thing, and I said chewing on cardboard because that's my attitude about a lot of the diet stuff that I've tried to eat.
By the way, after I took no-dos, I would eat cardboard, by the way. It was fairly regular, but go ahead, I'm sorry.
So what I think the message may be is that there's a lot of hidden calories out there. There's corn syrup and other sugary additives and products in almost, you know, from ketchup to who knows what. There's places you don't know that they're putting in a lot of sugar. I don't think the proper message is that there are certainly evil bad calories and better calories. You know, at the end of the day, your body doesn't care where they came from. It just cares how many you ate. So that's the key to obesity reduction. But you do need to be alert. And I think the message is partly there, that there's a lot of hidden calories. That's probably what they're getting at.
But isn't part of the thing that if you have a comparable number of calories from something that's healthy, I don't know, nuts, yep, vegetables, those sort of things, have the same amount of calories from sugar, the nut and vegetable calories don't lead you to go back for more. But the sugar calories have a certain addiction thing, and they do cause you to go back for more.
They're more filling.
What's that? Well, whatever the filling. Well, exactly. So it's addiction. It's satisfaction. That part is true, isn't it, or is it?
Yeah, no. There's truth in that, and it is true that, you know, certain calories are a lot more nutritional than nuts, than just eating my favorite candy bars or something. So that's all true. But at the end of the day, you still can't go out and eat. You know, I've seen people say, "Well, I'm on a diet. I'm going to go with cereal in the morning. No more of those donuts. I'll just have my six bowls of cereal before I get going here." And it's sort of like, "Well, I don't know. Even if it's muesli or something healthy, it's still you can't eat six bowls of it." So that's my only point. But yes, you're absolutely right. So some foods fill you up more. Some foods leave you with a longing. I think you can get addicted to the sugar high. I get all that. I just want people to understand, at the end of the day, you don't need the diet book. You don't need all that. You just got to eat less calories.
Hey, by the way, before you go away, I want you to know about a week ago, I forgot to mention last week, I saw you on CNN with our former colleague, whom we love, Michael Smirkanish.
That was Donald Sterling. Oh, that was Donald Sterling.
Oh, of course.
Michael Smirkanish is
not
great.
Only did you look great, you sounded great, Art Kaplan, so I didn't want another week to pass without telling you.
You want to tell him again how great a story was about Michael Sam?
What's that?
Want to tell him again?
It was great. It was a great piece.
Okay.
Hey, Art.
That's why I may be the only medical ethicist you know, but still the favorite.
Exactly. Hey, Art, good to speak to you.
That's right. Art Kaplan, thank you very much for talking with us today. Art Kaplan is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He also co-edited the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Up next, we continue our round of gubernatorial candidate interviews with Democrat Don Berwick. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Poet Marjorie Agosin moved to the U.S. from Chile as a teenager. It was not a good experience. And when she writes now, she thinks of young immigrants coming to the U.S. today.
I want them to feel welcomed and mostly to feel loved, because I did not feel loved when I went to school in Athens, Georgia.
A poet remembers starting over in America. That's on the world.
This afternoon at 3 here on WGBH Radio.
WGBH Radio exists thanks to you and Mass Art Professional and Continuing Education, a place to get creative and get involved. Registering now for summer classes in art and design. You can find more information at massart.edu/CE. And Rockport Music, presenting their annual Chamber Music Festival, opening June 6th with the Boston area debut of the new Emerson String Quartet with cellist Paul Watkins at the Shalin Liu Performance Center. RockportMusic.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. We are continuing our interviews with the gubernatorial candidates. Joining us in Studio 3 is Dr. Don Berwick. He's a former administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Prior to his work in the Obama administration, he was president and chief executive officer of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. He's running for governor on the Democratic side. Don, good to see you again.
Nice to be back. Thanks.
Thank you for coming in, Don Borick. So let's start with some current events. There's been kind of a messy situation with the casinos in Massachusetts and other candidates. Actually, you and Joe Avalon are up both on the Democratic side, are the only candidates who have not asked for Steve Crosby, the Gaming Commission chair, to step down. You said recusal's enough. So why do you think that?
I think recusal is enough given what we know so far. I think the bigger picture here is look at the amount of suspicion and controversy and things gone wrong with the casino move. I continue to feel I'm the only candidate for governor and that is opposing casinos and favoring this repeal. It's a bad move for the state, and this to me is it's an indication of the kind of trouble we can get into. It's not good for us. It'll add to petty crime and DUIs in our neighborhoods. It'll hurt small businesses. And especially important to me as a physician, you know, it adds gambling addiction to a state where we're already struggling with mental health problems and substance abuse. It's a very bad move.
So let's assume on the same day that you're elected governor of Massachusetts, the SJC, the Supreme Judicial Court, decided to put the question on the ballot and people reject the repeal. Mm-hmm. So we have casinos and we have Don Berwick. What does Governor Don Berwick do with a law that was reaffirmed by the people of his state?
Well, I have to implement it, but absolutely diligent support to a very, very strong commission. We have to watch these places like a hawk. And I'm especially concerned about a pattern that's appeared in some states when casinos enter, they end up with online gambling just a few years later. And that, to me, just triples the problem, even more difficulties. I would strongly try to keep us from slipping
down that slope.
But
aren't we too far already? We started a lottery, and my understanding is it's the most successful lottery in the country in terms of payouts to the, what are they called, gamblers, whatever they are, buyers of tickets. We returned close to $1 billion, I think, give or take a few, to cities and towns, which is obviously a lifeblood. A couple of years ago, Marjorie and I went to a restaurant near her hometown in Fall River where every table had a Keno game on it. That was the year I think they sped up the turnover of games from 5 minutes
to
every
didn't
4 minutes.
It. I thought it was lots of fun. In between a bite of your pasta, you place another bet, go back to the pasta.
If it turns out casinos are a bad idea, and I know they're one form of gambling and arguably they can have some worse attributes, all the studies on the lottery, for example, have shown it's Robin Hood in reverse. Poorest communities spend the most and rich communities get dollars for local aid, even though no one plays. Would part of your agenda be to scale back on our overall reliance on gaming as to fund services?
These are regressive ways to raise revenues. We are in the lottery, but we can go back now. It is almost $1 billion, and the money's very well used. Notice that if casinos enter the scene with near certainty, it'll cannibalize the lottery. We'll probably lose, I guess, a third of the lottery revenue because that money will move over to casinos. I think casinos do add an especially onerous, especially egregious form of gambling addiction. It's a different matter. No, not many people that go to casinos get that addiction, but when it occurs, it's really, really serious. And by the way, the addiction itself is maldistributed. That is, people of lower income, and especially people in minority communities, are more likely to be addicted in gambling parlors. We have that information in casinos. We have that information as well. So I wouldn't look back now on the lottery, but I think we ought to draw a line in the sand here.
You know, one last thing for me in the casino thing. You said that you think, as far as we know, with what we know now, that Steve Crosby can recuse himself from the decision on the Boston area casinos and then stay on as commissioner. But the people on the other side, not just the gubernatorial candidates, but just people in the public, have talked about a lack of confidence in Crosby, even though everybody says he's a great guy, great public servant, and so forth. Particularly this last incident with the showing up at Suffolk Downs on Kentucky Derby Day, showing a big lack of judgment. So what about that confidence? Because it is so fraught with difficulty.
Public confidence matters. It was a mistake. I think, recusal is the moment of remedy enough for me, but we have to watch this very carefully. Public servants do have to adhere to an extremely high bar standard of ethics, and I don't gainsay that. And, we'd watch – I think he should stand on advisement that no more mistakes to be okay. But the other thing is there's a bigger policy issue here, which is although we have to keep earning public trust, a head on a platter firing someone and saying now we fix the system, that's a mistake. I've been an executive for 30 years. I've worked with the workforce. My whole attitude is let's get pride and joy in the workforce and work on systems that support them. So, yes, we have to watch that carefully. Maybe he should resign at some point in the future should there be future mistakes, but that's not the same as making the right policies and systems.
Okay. Well, speaking of heads on a platter, there were those who thought that Olga Roche from the Department of Children and Families was a head on a platter because the agency is very troubled to begin with. It's always been troubled, actually, and that no one was really going to step in with only a few months left into Val Patrick's term, so that firing Olga Rochet was not helping children. It was just putting a head in the platter to satisfy the people that were screaming about her alleged incompetence.
Well, look, Marjorie.
And by the way, I should point out, you were in favor of her firing.
I was not initially. I didn't think it was a remedy that was serious, but it came to time. It was time for her to leave. I know that. And you're absolutely right, Marjorie. The public trust really matters. I don't want to not emphasize that point like you are, but it really is true that what happened in DCF. It reflects systemic issues which afflict the workforce. They make it harder for good people to do their work. And a good leader, a good executive, makes it possible for the workforce to do things right. So you look at the information systems in the Commonwealth, the training and support to the DCF social workers, the amount of budget they have to do their work, their interaction with other agencies, cooperating across boundaries, all of that has to go right in order for people, including someone like Olga, to do their work properly. A good leader doesn't point fingers all the time at the workforce. They make it possible for them to do their work well. And that's the responsibility I'd like to take.
What convinced you, you switch your positions, as you said a minute ago, Don Berwick, Democratic candidate for, candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor. Originally, you thought she shouldn't go. Subsequently, you said you did. What caused the change of heart?
Two things: the accumulating evidence of how much was going wrong in the division, but also it's what Marjorie was saying. It's when the public does lose trust, even if at that moment it isn't exactly the full remedy, we do have to respond to it. And I don't want to be dismissive of the public's sentiments, but my main point is this: good leaders work on building systems and supports that allow the workforce to do well, and don't ever assume that firing someone is going to fix the system. That's really rarely the case.
Okay, let's talk about good leaders. Someone you've said some good things about. Building systems, and one system is a healthcare website that has been an unmitigated disaster. Somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 million is going to be spent to either replace it, according to the direction of the Blue Cross person who's on loan to fix this, or for us to essentially buy into the national website, which is obviously improving. Could you have handled this any better, or would you have handled this any differently than Deval Patrick has?
It's Monday morning quarterbacking, sure. But I think that this is a management failure.
On his part?
It's a management failure on the state's part, whether he specifically is responsible for it. I suppose at some level, you are the executive. But what's going on here appears to me to be issues of cooperation among the various holders of information in the state, the interfaces among state agencies. But the other thing that's going on, I point out here, is that one of the reasons that website failed is because of the complexity of the payment system. The interfaces are massive with the Internal Revenue Service and federal agencies, among insurers within the state, with Medicaid. This is a bear of a problem, which is one of the reasons I'm supporting single-payer health care, Medicare for all in the state. This was partly the result of a healthcare payment system that's just gotten so complex we can't even manage it properly, let alone individuals being able to read their bills. We could simplify that healthcare system, and that would make things like that website a lot easier.
But you know what you hear all the time about when people bring up single-payer health care? You know, there's a lot of appeal to it. You wouldn't have the insurance companies. You wouldn't have all that money going to them and so forth. But you see these mess-ups with the Health Connector. You see the mess-ups like a Department of Children and Families. You see mess-ups on the national level. And there's a fear, and I don't think it's an unfounded fear, that if the government gets this big and runs everything, where's my recourse? You know, who am I going to call when I can't get my blood pressure medication or whatever? You know what I mean?
I got you. So, well, first, bad management's bad management, whether it's on the public side or the private side. And one of the reasons I'd like to be governor is to bring the executive skills I have to that corner office and really insist on the state functions running with the highest standards that businesses do. But businesses screw up too. Look at what happens with our credit cards, you know, a few months ago. So, no, this is the commitment here has to be to sound management and executive leadership. When government manages healthcare insurance, it's a lot more efficient than the private sector. I ran Medicare and Medicaid. My overhead rate was 1%. The national overhead rate for – we're trying to get the national overhead rate for insurers down to 15% in this state. Part of the market's regulated at 10%, but there's a big difference between 1% or 2% and 10%. That money could be harvested back and devoted to other things we really need to devote ourselves to. And in terms of accountability, Marjorie, try calling your insurance company and pleading your case. There is no accountability. There isn't transparency. It's not publicly accountable. If we were to set up a state-based single payer properly, as a kind of authority structure would be correct, mm-hmm. a little distance from political winds, one of their jobs is to represent the people and be accessible to you. So you have somebody to go to bat for you. And I would challenge you. I think you'll have a much better time doing that. Even today, you have a better time doing that in Medicare than you would with a private insurance company.
Yeah, but you don't exactly. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, Jim always used this line, you know, single payer is Medicare. And everybody always says they're pretty happy with their, yes. with their Medicare system. I've always wondered why there isn't some that isn't emphasize more trying to push the single payer. Hey, look at your grandma. Look at your mother. She thinks this is great.
Well, you noticed Don Berwick called it Medicare for All, by the way.
That's the best way to think about it. There's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of intentional confusion. The opponents of making healthcare a human right in America have pervaded a set of myths. They're lies, really, about what's going on, what can go on, that unfortunately the public has not had a lot of counter-education to. And I think there was a communication failure in the Obama administration around Obamacare, which has a lot of good news in it, and that news didn't get out. But to make it really simple, we are talking about pooling the money in the state that goes out to pay health care. We're not talking about a government takeover of health care. This is every doctor, every hospital, every nurse continues to do their practice. They can even be in competition with each other. But now the public has voice. They have control over the flow of that money. The overhead rates are lower. It's a chance to make sense out of chaos right now, and people don't like it. As I go around the state, by the way, I must tell you, I'm really surprised at the number of people who really seem to want this. That's not why I took the position. I took the position because I think it's the right one. But, man, people are really very interested in this idea.
But speaking about leadership, Don Berwick, aren't you worried that when the lack of confidence in what government does on a whole host of levels, some of which is well-founded, some of which is not, isn't the job of the leader, at least in the short term, to restore confidence in what is rather than talking about what isn't that should be? And you know what I mean. I mean, this is not exactly on many issues a bold legislature, even though they're all Democrats. So you assume they sit in a room and they figure out what to do with the Democratic governor, if there is a Democratic governor. There may be Charlie Baker or Mark Fisher or an independent, who knows. But assuming it's a Democrat, but they're not bold. And so isn't your first job to convince people we can fix this website, we can make the current system work, I have a better idea, but right now I'm going to make sure what is works properly. Yeah, isn't that where the focus should be?
Well, it's both. I just have my cake and eat it too. We want to manage the present and build the future. And I'm by saying that I think we should move to single payer doesn't mean that we shouldn't manage every nickel and dime and every patient and taxpayer experience properly. That goes across government here. You know, to earn the trust of the people, which we're going to need to really build the bold progressive agenda that I want to make this state the model for the country, and to build that public sentiment, every encounter that people have with government matters. This applies to the motor vehicles department and what happens to small businesses when they're trying to get a license to do something. We have to manage government the way a fabulous company manages its relationships with its customers. And there is well-defined management methodology for that. And that's what I've taught and learned and tried to practice for 3 decades now.
Are you the only Democrat who supports repeal of the casino law? Is that correct?
Yes.
Are you the only Democrat who supports single payer?
I'm the only committed to it, yes.
So assuming that – and I have been to many of these Democratic state conventions. They are, it's fair to say, I think you'd agree, the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, just like the Republican convention is generally the conservative wing. In light of the fact that on 2 issues that, in my estimation, are essential to the so-called progressive agenda as there is, and in light of the fact that the progressives amongst progressives are those who are going to be in Worcester in June – why, outside of you, is there a question as to whether or not you're going to get 15% of the votes to put you on the ballot? Based on your positions on the issues, an objective person might argue, why are you not winning this convention, much less are you even going to qualify for the ballot in September? I know you're going to say you are, but a lot of experts say it's going to be a tough road to hoe.
I'm one who says
it's a tough road to hoe. I mean, Coakley and Grossman are going to get a lot of votes.
Yeah,
don't you agree?
The cards are stacked for insiders, of course, since it's a party structure. But no, we're doing great. I mean, you've read my answer. I mean, we have the 15%. I'm confident. I think we're going to do very, very well at that convention. But I think as I experience the Democratic Party and electorate, including the delegate universe, which, of course, I'm in touch with all the time now, it's a pretty broad tent. I mean, there are people all the way from a kind of centrist Democratic position to the bold progressive positions I have. What does unite this Party, and I think reunites the state, is at a different level. It's values. It's the values of social justice, equality, compassion in public life. I think we're in a state in which people really do want to help take care of each other. And I'm building my plea that way, my campaign that way. I think that's what's going to win this campaign for me. It's that we are sick and tired of a country in which people are backing down from the commitment to each other and being encouraged by their leaders to do that. That's not in the hearts of people. I don't think in the nation, let alone the state. And that's what's going to make me successful.
Let me tell you what I also think is in the hearts of people, just like you have your sense. I don't think people like one-party government. Mm-hmm. And even if they're Democrats, unless you are really hardcore, you think that some balance is of a good thing. We read in the paper that it is fairly likely the Republican State Committee is not going to be able to field virtually any candidates for the 9 congressional seats, maybe 3, something like that. Obviously, Richard Tesei is a serious candidate to John Tierney's seat on the North Shore. I don't even know if there's a candidate I should. I'm embarrassed to run against Ed Markey, a pretty important position. Offices below governor and lieutenant governor are unlikely to have any candidates, or at least serious candidates. So tell the voters why it is not in their interest, unless they think, let's say Charlie Baker is the nominee for the moment, even though he does have a primary, unless he is the Antichrist. Tell a fence-sitting voter why it is not better to have somebody who may not be quite as good in your mind as the Democratic nominee, whoever he or she is. Why is it not better to have a Charlie Baker who will provide at least some balance in a government that federally and in the state is virtually all Democratic?
Well, I would tell a fence-sitting voter, don't vote for a political theory. Vote for what you care about and listen to the candidates and decide which person who wants to be governor reflects the investments and the directions that you'd like to see this community and Commonwealth move forward about. It's not about parties. It's about values. And by the way, it so happens right now in the Republican Party, they're quite extreme. If you read the Republican Party platform, we're talking about taking food away from kids and cutting back on security for workers who really want to work hard 40 hours a week to feed their families. We're talking about a loss of the kind of commitments I care about.
But Baker doesn't agree with much of that platform. The position on choice, the position on gay marriage, even though it's obliquely stated, he's distanced himself.
See how much he wants to distance himself. He picked a running mate that signed the party platform, and he's going to be backed by a party that wants this state to turn red. And I think no. And by the way, if you're worried about, one-party system, visit the Democratic Party. It's a very big tent, very big tent. And I meet legislators and people all over the state who don't agree with me, and they're Democrats.
We're talking with Don Berwick, who's running as a Democrat to be the next governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. So Don Berwick, Marty Walsh, new mayor of Boston, he was very clear about his first priority if he became mayor, and of course he did, and he talked about violence in the inner city of Boston. Is there a Don Berwick number one priority should you pull this off?
It's a tough question. I get asked it often. I mean, the real answer is I've got a list of things I really want to get done, and they center on the value structure. So my number one priority really is about values. It's restoring, without apology, the vocabulary among us about a compassionate community and what it's like and how it behaves and how to use government to achieve that. We've backed away from that vocabulary, and we can't allow that to happen. And I think people want it. They're ready for it. And it's a basis for making a whole lot of decisions. If I have to pick one issue, I'll pick two.
Yes.
Education's got to be a lead. I mean, if you look at kind of a public investment that restores jobs, grows an economy, gets joy into our growth and development as human beings, it's that. So, universal pre-K for not just for kids, for families. In pre-K, you have to help the parents, not just the kid, in order to have successful kids, especially in stress circumstances. In elementary and secondary, it's supporting teachers. I think teachers, they're not the problem, they're the solution, and I'm really invested in helping the teacher workforce not be in handcuffs, but be able to go ahead and do the work they want to do.
What do you mean handcuffs? By rules and curriculum?
High-stakes testing, all of the teach-to-the-testing stuff. We need some standards. We are making some progress, but we have overshot.
Does that mean we should have more charter schools?
I'm in favor of charter schools to a limited extent. And yes, if a community wants to raise the cap a little, I would go with that. But charter schools they have a contract with us. They are set up not to harm the public education system. They're set up to help it. There should be a feeder system for ideas. So my current position on charters is cautious. Yes, if they share their lessons learned, they don't skim, so they're taking the kids from the system and not sending tough ones back to the system, and no for-profit charters. And then there's a higher education system. We've got 29 colleges, public colleges and universities and community colleges. What a tremendous asset they are for us. The other priority for me, of course, is healthcare reform. I know a lot more than any other candidate about what better healthcare at lower cost looks like. This state could get there. It's going to take real backbone to get us there, and that will release literally hundreds of millions, possibly billions of dollars of wasted resource now that can be reinvested in the things we need to get done.
I know you're a pediatrician. We only have a minute left. So you've dealt with real people, not just run agencies, run organizations. In truth, what is it like to have to do what you're doing now, where you basically have to go be a salesman? You have to go sell yourself. Yeah. Vast majority of people don't know who you are, or at least didn't know who you are. They don't know what your background. What's that like for you as a human being, Don Berwick, in our final minute here?
It's great. It's not the selling part. It's the listening part. You know, when you're a good doctor, you shut up a little while and just listen to what people want and feel, and what are their words? What's happening in their lives, and how can I help them? And I'm just trying to link that to what I want to get done and search for that overlap. I don't think I have time to tell you stories, but they're moving on the trail when I meet people and just ask them, why are you here? Why are you doing this?
Can
I tell
you? Next time. Please. Next time you come in.
Start next time with that.
Please ask me.
Yeah. Don Berwick, thank you
very much
for being with us. Don Berwick is running for the governor on the Democratic ticket. Up next, WGBH's arts editor Jared Bowen joins us to go over the latest movies and plays to hit Boston. Stay tuned to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, for that conversation.
Thank you.
A TV deal killing this former TV star's buzz.
I think consumers will end up paying more. There'll be less competition. There'll be less innovation and worse, even worse service.
Al Franken is the junior senator from Minnesota on why he's opposed to the Comcast-Time Warner merger. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
Support for our programs comes from you and Xconomy.com, presenting Boston 2034 on June 10th. Exploring the ideas, innovators, and companies poised to drive the economy in the years to come. More at xconomy.com/Boston2034. And State Street, partnering with institutional investors worldwide to create the way ahead, and proud to support TED Radio Hour in the Innovation Block each Thursday at 11 p.m. here on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Woody Allen is playing a pimp on the big screen. And on the small stage, the Randy Ryan Landry of Gold Dust Orphans gives Snow White a twisted makeover. Here with us in Studio 3 to go over the latest hits and misses in the art world is WGBH's arts editor. That'd be Jared Bowen. Hello there, Jared.
Good afternoon. Great to be with you both.
Okay, we have to start with Woody Allen playing a creepy pimp, as these headlines read. Let's hear this little bit of the trailer from, I think, a poor choice for Woody Allen, Fading Gigolo.
I was at my dermatologist today. She was with her girlfriend, and they came to the conclusion that they both wanted to have a menage.
This came out of nowhere.
Out of nowhere. And she asked me, do I know anybody? I said, yeah, but it'll cost you $1,000. I was thinking of you.
Okay, Jared, this is just months after we went through this whole scene with Woody Allen being accused in great detail by his daughter of sexual molestation, and now he's playing a pimp. What did you think?
Well, first of all, I think the thing that we have to keep in mind is that they always shoot these movies at least a year in advance.
Uh-huh.
So this was well before everything resurfaced. But that's the point, isn't it? It resurfaced. All of these allegations are out there against Woody Allen. I've talked with you guys before. I think it's repulsive that Woody Allen married his daughter wife. And so it's very difficult to appreciate, you know, sort of Woody Allen, the personality. I've been able to watch his films because that's the problem. You have to reconcile the fact that he's a great artist in his films, Blue Jasmine, Batman last year was fantastic.
Fantastic.
But this is different. First of all, I have to say that it's a great movie, but it's John Turturro's movie. He wrote it. He directed it. It's just like a Woody Allen movie because it's small. There's jazz music, quirky story set in New York. But my problem is it is now difficult to see Woody Allen on the screen. And yes, Marjorie, why would he play a pimp? Why would he do that where he's orchestrating sex for people? And he has a much younger wife in this film. I mean, it's beyond my comprehension why he would do this.
When was the last time he was in a film that wasn't his? Marjorie and I were talking earlier this morning. I can't think of one.
Really long time. The last one that I can recall, and there might have been one since, is Scenes from a Mall with Ben Midler.
Yeah.
And Paul Mazursky directed that one. But it's been a really long time.
So he sort of went out of his way to get this role. It seems like it wasn't a film he created. It was a film.
Well, I'm assuming he was approached, but he still had to say yes.
Yeah, he has a friendship with John Turturro, and I think that he's been John Turturro's mentor to some degree. So when he was writing this, John Turturro, of course, was thinking Woody Allen. I mean, it's a classic Woody Allen role, and he, if you can remove yourself, which again I say it's hard to do, he is pretty entertaining, and it's such a shame because it really is a great movie, and it's a great story because it's about these sexual connections that John Turturro is having with these women who just have this longing. And then, of course, they quickly realize that it's more than just sex. It's a deeper relationship that all of these people are missing.
And Woody Allen is essentially, as the pimp, is looking for what? Rich middle-aged women to set up with this guy? Is that what the demo is?
Exactly. So he's making, his bookstore is about to close in New York City. And so he needs to make some extra money. So he sets John Turturro up with these very wealthy women, Sofia Vergara and Sharon Stone.
You know, one of the things, just staying on this whole issue of can you watch it? I mean, I am with you on the Sun Yi thing. But I've gone to virtually every Woody Allen movie since. And why, in anticipation of seeing this, which I will, I feel the same way you do. But why is it that we forgive some for their off-screen sins? I'm not saying that this isn't more, obviously he denies the charges, we should say. I watch Baldwin all the time and I laugh all the time. He seems to be a horrible human being to virtually everybody. Why is it I'm able, I don't consciously think about this, to forgive him, but I'm totally unforgiving through the years of Woody Allen, long before this issue about his kid, the daughter resurfaced. Why do we make these distinctions?
Well, I think there's one difference.
What is it?
I think Baldwin has acknowledged some of his faults and frailties. And Woody
Even
Allen.
Even though he keeps doing them.
He keeps doing them, but he does, apologize and says it was a bad thing for him to berate his daughter at the time he did on the phone. We all heard that tape. But Woody Allen has denied, and I don't believe him, so it makes it a real problem for me.
I have the exact same thought that with Alec Baldwin, even Mel Gibson, you know who you're getting. You know who the people are. You know that they're troubled, and they've somewhat openly discussed this. But I have the same issue that Woody Allen has – and, of course, these are all allegations as it pertains to Farrow's daughter and the molestation of Dylan Farrow. But we already know what happened with Sun Yi Previn and how he had nude pictures of her. I mean, that's the part that I can't reconcile and walk away from.
A woman that was, I think, 9 or 10 years old when she came to be in the household that he never lived with Mia Farrow, but certainly they were in the house a lot. So he watched this woman grow up, and he took these pictures of her when she was a teenager still.
Yep.
Okay, so I say I'm going to see this gigolo thing.
The fun. You
now I don't know if I can go see Fed Up though, because I don't know if I can.
Oh, you have to.
Now Fed Up is it's Laurie David, right? It is Katie Couric who narrates. Did she write this thing as well, Katie Couric?
I don't believe she wrote it. The director wrote it.
And the subheading could be Sugar Kills. I mean, that's the theme of this movie, right?
It is. It is. This is fascinating. And you just had Michael Pollan on the show.
Yes, I love him.
Great.
I am obsessed with food and the food industry and farming in this country, and I have read all of Michael Pollan's books, and so I thought I knew so much going into this movie, and I thought, I'll go see it because it's my job. But it was such a revelation because I didn't realize the extent to what sugar it really is toxic, and one of the most memorable scenes in this film is how they have these two sets of rats from one study, and they gave the rats cocaine and they gave them sugar, and the rats, by this huge preponderance, went back to the sugar because that's how addictive it is, and they gave up the cocaine.
That's great. right?
Really?
So it's this great documentary all about the food industry and the power that the food industry in this country has amassed over the last 30 years. And they liken the food industry to big tobacco. I mean, that's the kind of power that they have. It's the lobby that they have, the money that they have, and the marketing that they employ to get kids into this food that is so unhealthy for them.
And what I was not aware of, and I'm sort of obsessed with labels. You often think people don't read the labels. I read them. What I never noticed, and I think this point is made in the film, Jared, correct me if I'm wrong, is that while virtually everything else we're told, fat and sodium, how much of the percentage daily recommended amount is on the label, sugar is the one exception that they don't tell us that?
They have the sugar in grams, and who knows what a gram is,
of course.
Right? Speaking of cocaine, I guess, what we were just saying. But yeah, you're right. Sugar is the only thing on the label that they don't give you the percentage. And that is because we are supposed to have this very minimal percentage of sugar per day. And with the food, the sugar that's put into foods now, it's off the charts how much we're consuming. Because what happened is back in the early 1980s, when suddenly the mantra became fat is bad for you, they took fat out of all the food so that they could put reduced fat or no fat on the labels. But in order to make the food not taste like cardboard, they put sugar into it. And so that's why they try to mask, first of all, that it's sugar because they have all these different names, but then they mask the percentage of that you're getting every day. And the most heartbreaking thing is this is framed around the film opens. You see these young, morbidly obese kids, teenagers. I mean, they're just distraught. One girl breaks down into tears at one point. She says, I exercise. I can't understand why I'm not losing weight.
Oh.
And it's because her parents say the same thing. We don't know what's wrong. We're doing all the right things. But they open the cupboard and it's non-fat this, low-fat that. But it's all the processed
sugar
foods that we're not supposed to be eating.
Michael Pollan's in this, making the same point he made in his book Cooked and with us yesterday, the single most important way to combat, most effective way to combat obesity, he says in the movie, right, is to cook your own food, yes?
Exactly, because this is the scary part. You can't exercise off this problem. There's so much sugar in that you cannot, if you run for, what is it, an hour and 20 minutes, that might erase the cookie or the soda that you ate. That's
well,
it.
One of the things that I thought I read about this film in one of the reviews is that the percentage of food in the supermarket shelves that contain sugar, some astronomical amount, like 60 or 70%, and it's hidden in things you wouldn't expect.
Like
it to
ketchup,
be
those kind of
like
things.
Exactly, and spaghetti sauce, and peanut butter, and all these things you don't expect.
And salad dressing. I mean,
salad
it's
right
in everything. And even worse, I'm so obsessed by this, I can't stop talking about it. It's in schools, too. There's some staggering number. I want to say I think it's 80% of school districts in this country have a relationship, a formal relationship with Pepsi and Coke, which own Papagino's and Pizza Hut and all those. So this is what the kids are eating in so many school districts. There are all these pizzas that are just loaded with all this stuff, too. Like one of the doctors says schools have become 7-Elevens with books.
That is a fabulous line. Okay, let's talk about a movie that I have less than no desire to see. This is Neighbors. Here's a little scene from Neighbors with Zac Efron, Rose Byrne, and Seth Rogen. Here it is.
Look, new neighbors.
Oh.
What do we got?
Is that a fraternity? We have to go over there. We've got to be cool.
And we say, by the way, keep it down.
Well, we won't say it like that. Just like, keep it down.
What are you doing with this?
Keep it down.
Just don't.
So.
We've overworked it. Just wanted to say welcome to the hood.
You're welcome.
Also, if you could maybe just
keep it down.
Anyway,
make sure if we're too noisy, call me first. Don't call the cops.
That's all I can take of this. Okay, so essentially, this movie's been made 10,000 times. Just a variation of theme. So Seth Rogen and his wife buy a little house, and next door, all of a sudden, the fraternity moves in, right? And Zac Efron, okay, give us like 30 seconds on how horrible this is.
It is not.
Unlike slapstick humor, by the way.
It is not even remotely horrible. This is the funniest movie I have seen in a really long time. It is 90 minutes. It's so tight. It's so funny. It explores this great new comedic territory. Seth Rogen is behind it all. This new sensibility. I laughed from beginning to end.
Oh, great.
I loved it. I thought it was so funny.
I guess you'll have to go, Jim.
Well, I do like slapstick humor. It's just, but haven't we, I know we haven't done Fraternity House. Well, actually, we have done a variation on that. Is there anything new? I mean, what's so great about it? Just
there is, and unfortunately, I don't think I can tell you any of what.
Because it's so foul. It's a sophomoric,
so
vulgar.
So tasteless.
I'll be there at 2:15 this afternoon.
In the best ways.
Speaking of tasteless, let's move to the theater. Last year, we had Ryan Landry in here. I never use the word genius. This guy is a genius. I saw Rudolph the Redneck Reindeer. He's done Phantom of the Opera, Mildred Fierce. He's got a new thing. Tell us about Snow White, Jared Bone.
You're going to make me say the title.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that.
It's right, like, okay, fine. So Riley, his latest is Snow White and the Seven Bottoms.
There's nothing wrong. That's fine.
It's cute.
Tell us about it.
Well, it's, of course, as always, Ryan Landry is doing this epic takeoff. So it's a takeoff of both, of course, the Grimm Tale and the Disney film. And he is dressed up as the evil queen in this piece. It is, again, so funny. And I really think it's the sharpest that Ryan Landry has ever been. He has his troupe, the Goldust Orphans, and they perform in the basement of Machine there in Fenway, which is a gay club. But they have turned this theater troupe into really the most amazing, exceptional group between the choreography, the singing, the performers, the writing now that they have. Again, this show is so tight and so funny. These one-liners that they just sling at you. He looks at his mirror, his evil, you know, his mirror that tells him the truth at one point, which is played by Olive Another. And she tells him, you're the top contestant on America's Got Talons. I mean, you just slinging. So, again, this is probably the only thing that I can actually recite back to you. But it's so funny. And I believe, just like Mildred Fierce, he's also taking this to New York. So Ryan Landry is totally blowing up at this point. I mean, he had a very successful run of Mildred Fierce last year in New York.
Have you ever seen any of his stuff?
No.
By the way, you go to this club.
I should go.
You go to this club. And by the way, the first thought, tell the truth. When you go to this club, the first thought you have is, I'm never getting out of here alive. This is.
Or with all your clothes.
It is, well, that too. Yeah. You are in a setting that is really tight. And if you're claustrophobic, it's an issue. But it's a great club. It is so creative. And so, again, I haven't seen this one. So funny. You really got to go. You love it.
So
me.
He has a very small audience there.
No, well, it's actually all over the place.
It's always packed. And the great thing about him is that Jim is totally right. It's boundless creativity with no pretense. That's the best part. I mean, it's low budget in all the ways that absolutely work.
And what you do, by the way, when you're there, is the first thing you do is you look around and say, who's from Iowa? This thing that they heard. And they're there, and they're sitting there incredibly uncomfortably. And then you look at them sideways 1 minute in, and they are rolling and laughed. It is really brilliant stuff. So moving from Snow White and the Seven Bottoms, I have no trouble talking about that. What's the deal with this Susan Sontag thing at Arts Emerson?
This is good. I feel like such a Pollyanna this time because there's so much good that's happening. But this Sontag Reborn is a show at Arts Emerson where they've gone back and they've taken this is by the Builders Association. It's a group in New York, and they've come in to do this in Boston, partly because of Susan Sontag's connections here with Harvard and whatnot. But they went back to her early journals. And so they crafted this show out of what she recorded from age 15 to 30. So you see the blossoming of this woman. And, of course, if anybody doesn't know, Susan Sontag is the great public intellectual and writer and activist and just so, so smart. But she was fierce and fearsome because she knew she was so smart and people perceived her that way. But you have this one woman, Mo Angelos, playing Susan Sontag, and it is fascinating to see her go from age 15 and grapple with this intellect that outpaces all of her peers and to see how she surveys life and so beautifully writes about it, but also to see her dealing with her body and her emerging sexuality, which in her case was an attraction to women. It's just fascinating.
Plays her as a kid, as a teenager, as well as a 30-something?
Yep. And not only that, but she also plays Susan Sontag as a much older adult and in a video, a black and white video that looms over the stage. The way they just direct this and present it is mesmerizing because at times the words just fly at you, too, through the scrim on the stage. But there's this black and white video of the older Sontag literally looking down at her younger self throughout the film. And every now and again, she comments or clarifies. And it's a reflection of what Susan Sontag actually did, which was she went through her journals and annotated them as an adult, and she was tough. She was very, very caustic, and she was very hard on herself. On herself, yeah.
How long is this here, by the way?
This is here through May 18th.
And we should have said, I think May 18th also on Ryan Landry's thing.
That's right.
Is it not?
Yep.
Snow White and the Seven Bottoms. Well, continuing your exaltation, apparently, Pricked, Boston Ballet, you are in exaltation, yes?
Yeah, this is perhaps the best I've ever seen Boston Ballet. I saw it just the other night, and this is an evening of mostly contemporary program. It actually begins with Etude, which is this classic ballet piece which was choreographed in the late 1940s, and it takes you from rehearsal, where you see women, the ballerinas at the bar doing their exercises, all the way through the whole range of ballet and the most astonishing dance movements, and Boston Ballet is exceptional now, and they They can do these with it'll just leave your jaw dropping. In fact, there was I've never seen this at Boston Ballet in my recollection, but there was a standing ovation just for this one piece alone. I was talking to a fellow critic of mine, Iris Fanger, who writes beautifully about dance, and she told me that when they tried to do this years ago, they would bump into each other on the stage. They needed blinkers. It just wasn't pretty. This is exceptional. And then they have these two other contemporary pieces.
Now, you just said Boston Ballet is exceptional now, and they would have been bumping into each other years ago. What happened?
All I can tell you is that I have covered the ballet for the last, I don't know, 7 or 8 years, and it's all been under the leadership of artistic director Mikko Nissinen. And he has really come in and tried to push this company forward, but not only push the dancers forward, but push, and I think he's probably in about his 12th year now, but push audiences forward. When he came in, audiences weren't ready in Boston for contemporary dance, and I think they are now, because the other two pieces are, one is called DMJ, 1953 to 1977. It really refers to the composers, and it's this, you get this sense of, you see these two lovers and you get the vestiges of their life danced out on stage. And the other one is called Cacti, that's the title pricked, which is hilarious. There's a lot of humor in the piece. At one point you have these two dancers dancing together and there's actually a voiceover and you can hear all of their thoughts, and it's extremely funny. I mean, they've introduced comedy into the Boston Ballet, and this is something that I, even when I started covering them, I don't think they could have done, but the company is so strong now and so tight that they can do just about anything, from the great story ballets to new works.
Is there anything you don't like?
There are lots of things, but I just have nothing.
Not
I don't
this week.
Like. We're in a great season right now.
One more quick question about the Boston Ballet. In the pantheon of ballet troupes around the country, where are we?
I think that we're rising. And for the last number of years, there's been a European tour of Boston Ballet, and you should see their notices in Europe.
Really?
Where those critics, of course, are tough and very exacting, and they have given rave notices to Boston Ballet, and then they're ending their season at Lincoln Center in New York. I mean, this is just such a triumphant time for this community.
Hey, fantastic. Speaking of dance, there's this public dance at Copley Square. Was it this coming weekend, or is that what it is?
This coming
what
Friday,
is it?
Saturday, Sunday. It's called Le Grand Continental. It's the celebrity series who dropped all those pianos around Boston last
fall. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
So they're ending their 75th season with this big public dance. They put out a call for amateur dancers. People signed up in January. They started rehearsals in February, two nights a week, 2 hours per rehearsal, to learn this 30-minute dance, which is this sort of epic line dance, but a mashup of all these different kinds of music. These people are so committed. I saw a rehearsal the other night, and they're all going to gather and perform it in Copley Square for free, of course. More than 100 dancers who've taken all these lessons. And this is something that it started in Montreal, and it's taken off. It's been done in a bunch of U.S. cities, in Mexico City, and now we have it here in Boston this weekend.
So, Jared Bowen, tell us about the Tony nominations.
Great news for the American Repertory Theater.
Ah!
We, of course, had Glass Menagerie and Bryan Cranston, whom you love.
He's looking at me as we say, well, the show, the play, all the way was was he, I know the play was nominated. Was Cranston nominated for Best Actor?
Bryan Cranston was nominated.
As LBJ.
And odds are favorite that he'll win the Tony for Best Actor. And then the Glass Menagerie received 7 Tony nominations.
Mm. Wow.
I mean, there's just so much that the ART is sending to New York now that's getting all these accolades. It's fantastic.
And they've got the Tempest, is it, that's opening at the ART soon?
Yeah, but with it's because the Tempest is largely about magic on this island. So Teller of Penn and Teller is doing the magic music by Tom.
We have him here, by the way. Teller's going to be with us on Thursday of this week, I believe.
Yeah. Oh, night. I see it on Thursday night. I'm really looking forward to this one.
So, are any of these things that are nominated that Tony? Is anything still here or going to be here? Was it early June? The awards with Hugh Jackman, a fairly good-looking guy, anything? Nothing is here that's nominated, is it, or is it?
Not at this point. No. And typically, what happens is, especially with the Tony nominations, the show becomes really successful, and then it'll tour. So it'll likely be here, perhaps a year from now.
Okay. So, Fading Gigolo, we know you loved. Fed Up, we know you loved. Snow White and the Seven Bottoms, Sontag Reborn, Pricked. But let's face it, there was nothing quite like Neighbors, was there? I mean, I'll tell you, when you talk to Jared Bowen, there's nothing like a couple moves into a house and a fraternity moves in next door. Wouldn't you say that, Jared?
You know, but Seth Rogen, when you look at him, I feel like Alec Baldwin with him. I look at him and I start to laugh. It's the same sort of thing. He's very funny and very appealing.
You're going to go to see Neighbors? I want to know.
I don't think I'll be going to see Neighbors. About a bunch of 30-year-old fraternity boys? No, I probably will not. Or 20-year-old fraternity boys.
I bet you will love it. I brought a colleague of mine, Azita Garamani, whom you know.
Who has one of the great senses of humor of our time.
She was rolling. She loved it so much.
Well, if it's good enough for Azita, it is good enough for us.
I did love Knocked Up. That was terrific, wasn't it?
This is way better. better.
Way Let me tell you, Knocked Up was good. Knocked Up, the sequel, is really... Knocked Up Again was really...
Knocked Over.
Thank you.
Jared,
good to see you.
Thank you for being with us as always. Jared Bowen is WGBH's arts editor. He's also the host of Open Studio. You can catch that on WGBH Channel 2 every Friday night at 8:30. Thanks, Jared.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Please tune in tomorrow for Ask the Governor with Governor Deval Patrick, here to take your questions and ours. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy.
Thanks for tuning in.